Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network, and be forewarned, there was a little problem with the host's audio in the following interview, but I hope that you enjoy it anyway. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Australian and New Zealand channel on the New Books Network. This afternoon, we have Matthew Ricketson. Matthew is an academic and a journalist. He's worked for 4 decades in those fields. He's presently a professor of communications at Deakin University. Before that, he has worked at RMIT, the University of Canberra, has been involved in news media with The Age and The Australian, Time Magazine Australia, and has also been involved in a few investigations into the state of journalism in Australia. So, and my name is Bede Haynes. So, good afternoon, Matthew. Thank you for joining us.
That's a pleasure, Bede. Happy to be here.
Now, you've written this book published by UNSW Press called, well, you've edited it and written a fair bit of it, Upheaval, Disrupted Lives in Journalism. First of all, could you explain the background to this book, how it came about and what its purpose is?
Sure. Okay, well, as you kind of said in your introduction there, I've edited and written part of it. My co-editor is Andrew Dodd, who's also an academic and a former journalist, and we are both members of an academic research team called the New Beats team, headed up by our colleague Laurie Zion out at La Trobe Uni, and basically this team was set up, you know, 8 or 9 years ago, when the first of these big rounds of job losses started happening in the mainstream media. And, you know, we can talk about the detail of that, but it was 2012 and it was at what was then known as Fairfax Media and News Limited. And Laurie and myself and Andrew and a couple of other colleagues, Penny O'Donnell and Tim Marjoribanks and Merrin Sherwood, all kind of had the same idea at the same time, which was, this is a kind of seismic moment in the media industry in this country, and we ought to kind of investigate what's going on. And we started off with the idea that, you know, there were around about 15% of the kind of total journalistic workforce was laid off in the space of less than a year back then, and we thought that a lot of these people might go and start kind of trying to reinvent journalism or make a startup media organization or something like that, because that was kind of what was in the air at the time. And there's no doubt that some people did that and some of them were successful in doing that. But what actually sort of happened over the next few years was that there were more rounds of redundancies, the media kind of got, or the big media companies got winnowed, and they kept doing annual kind of rounds of redundancies until about 2017, and then sort of stopped and have gradually started on an upswing since then, for reasons that we can kind of talk about in a bit more detail. But the kind of notion of reinventing journalism and so on hasn't really come about in a major or a systemic way. What's happened is that the mainstream, or what tends to be called these days the legacy media, got smaller and more fragmented. And as you have seen, social media, through your Facebook feed or other means, Instagram or whatever, that is the main mechanism now by which a lot of people gain access to news and ideas and information and so on. And a lot of it's still coming from those big media sites, but a lot of it isn't. And there's a lot of tonic in with the gin, if you like, if you know what I mean. There's a lot of all sorts of weird stuff going out there. And we're seeing the results of that in recent years with, you know, whether it's looking at the elections in the US or the crazy conspiracy theories about cures for the global pandemic, or disbelief that there's a global pandemic, or the idea that the world is run by a bunch of pedophiles in a pizza house back in the United States somewhere, these kinds of things. which have always been there, have just been turbocharged into the system by social media, and the legacy media is not as central or as powerful as it used to be.
Can I ask you this? There's in your answer just then, or in your comment just then, you've mentioned the concept of media, people who work in the media, and the concept of journalism. And I imagine there's a bright line between those two things, because a journalist isn't just someone who works in the media. It's actually a thing called a journalist. What is a journalist?
Sure. Okay. You're right. There's what you might call a way to distinguish is between talking about the practice of journalism and the business of the media. So the media, you know, whether it's Nine or Fairfax or News or, you know, West Australian or whatever, they are in the business of they're commercial enterprises. They need to make money and have revenue coming in. Journalism is something that you do, that you practice. You may do it in a newspaper run by the Nine organisation, or by News Limited or News Corporation Australia, as they're now known. Or you might do that in a small startup. You might do that at crikey.com.au. You know, there is an argument to say that if you are doing a podcast in the way that you are doing right now, you are doing journalistic work. That is, you're interviewing, your purpose is to discuss a new thing, in this case a book, for a broader audience and so on. That's a reasonable definition of what journalism is. And I prefer to think of it as what you do, because if you just think of who is a journalist and what, then, you know, you might not be included in that, but for my book, you are doing journalistic work. So I prefer to think of it as what you are doing, even though you're not working at, you know, the Herald Sun or whatever.
Yes. Your book also moves into a division. We'll talk about this in some more detail later, I think. But you mentioned already the concept of legacy media versus new media. And I take it from writing this book, you think there's something to worry about or something that needs to be is noteworthy about this change, and it's not necessarily a good thing. That's the vibe I got from the book. So how would you distinguish a change between what's happening now in the media with job losses and just a different reorganisation of the business compared to something, say, another societal change where 30 years ago there were local butchers, but now you buy your meat mostly from a supermarket. That's had consolidation as well. Is the consolidation in journalism something we should be concerned about?
Okay. I think that the most reliable estimates are that in the decade to the end of 2020, between 4,000 and 5,000 people who describe themselves as journalists have taken voluntary redundancies. Okay. Now, some of them have gone into the media elsewhere, but the great majority haven't. And I would liken that to, I don't know what sport you follow, if indeed you are a football fan, but if you were following a football team that has 22 people playing, you know, and you took out sort of 6 or 7 of them, what effect do you think that'd have on the football team? You know, it's going to have some kind of material effect. And when you think about some of the people who are no longer in the industry who used to be, and the volume of the number of people who are no longer in the broad media industry that used to be, I do think that has had an impact, and the book kind of shows that, and the people who are interviewed for it are concerned about it as well. They're concerned about less detailed reporting on matters of public interest, whether it might be something which is a bit, you know, chewy, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty or something like that, which is not going to be for everyone, but it's actually an important kind of treaty among countries, and to understand its impact on the economy and so on, you need, you know, experienced journalists who follow that kind of thing in detail to kind of discuss it and unpack it and work out what it's all about and so on. So there's some concern there from the people who are interviewed for the book about that. At the same time, and I don't want to sound kind of like a Pollyanna on this, but at the same time, the internet has enabled the doing of journalism in all sorts of ways that just were simply not possible 20, 30 years ago. Like what we're doing right now was not possible, you know, 30 years ago. And you can gather so much information so quickly via online sources now, which quickens your job. So there is an argument to say you don't need as many people, you know, so there's that. And there's all sorts of information that is available online now that never used to be. Like you could never find in the past, unless you happen to be working in a law, you know, in a law firm, you couldn't find judgments of the courts. They were hard to get. Now you can. You can read them yourself. You can critique them if that's what you want to do. That's a net benefit to society in terms of the dissemination of information and discussion of it. So I'm not for a moment saying that everything is, nor is the book saying that things have gone downhill but there is something to be concerned about, and that is to do with what I think I was talking about before, which is the diminution of legacy media in terms of size and scale. And within the broad media ecosystem where there are so many other things, whether it's through social media, whether it's misinformation sites or indeed disinformation sites, which are deliberately spreading, bad quality information. It's not an either or, it's a both. There are some good things and there are some bad things, but you'd have to say that if you're looking at some of the trends in the world at the moment, you would be alarmed by, you know, if you think to yourself, a decade ago, would we have envisaged the riots at the Capitol on the 6th of January at the beginning of the year? It's pretty hard to envisage that. Would we have envisaged some of the responses to a global pandemic, especially when you compare it to the way in which people responded to the Spanish flu a century ago? People who openly do not believe that the global pandemic is happening and will do almost anything up to and including dying rather than admit the fact that it exists and rather than go and get themselves vaccinated. That strikes me as a very odd place that we're in at the moment, and the role of the kind of broad media ecosystem in that I don't know exactly what it is, but I think there's something there.
Yes, and the legacy media, it seems, what are your thoughts on this? The legacy media, so we have an example you've just given, for example, about the 6th of January attacks event in Washington, and also misinformation about pandemic. That would exist amongst the user networks on things like Facebook. But I'm not part of that, but I know all about it through the legacy media, essentially. So it's almost as though they you can't have one without the other. They both, which probably have the Facebook bit. But if you've got the Facebook bit, it seems to ride on the back of the legacy media, so everyone knows about it, like along the line.
Yeah, no, that's true. The fact that there are the fact that the riots happened at the Capitol in Washington on the 6th of January, we know about that. Let me go back a step and take what you're suggesting, if it was right. That is, if there was no legacy media, how would we know about that event? I mean, there would be certainly a lot of people who were using their own mobile phones to shoot footage of that event. And that would have gone out, and that would have gone to all of their followers, and gradually it might have trickled out. But what I think you're getting at is that there is a kind of infrastructure of the legacy media which performs some functions of verifying that information, of curating it, of organizing it into a form that is more readily digestible than a kind of a 3-hour feed on someone's phone, just their phone running nonstop up at the Capitol. And then there's other, equally if not more important tasks of asking questions about that and putting the event in context and then going to political leaders or other leaders in the community and saying, what do you think about this, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a kind of, there are both things operating at once. But I think you're right that if the media infrastructure wasn't there, I can only imagine it would be even more chaotic and less, not only less organized, but less bound by a set of principles to do with ideas about both sharing information, but also civic discourse and questioning and so on and so on.
Yes. Now, question about your book itself. The book is set to be edited by Andrew Dodd and yourself, although you do also seem to do a lot of writing in the book. Editing is of course part of your role, but you also have essays and things like that in the book.
Sure.
The book also has a lot of sort of interviews that have been written up in certain ways, and a lot of people have contributed to this book. How did it come together?
Okay, I'm glad you asked that, because I think I mentioned earlier it came out of the academic research group, the New Beats team. So when we're doing a number of things, academic articles and so on and so on. That's kind of what you do when you get a research grant. You helps you do all of that. What we as a group had in mind as one of the things that we would do would be to tell the stories of the journalists who'd taken voluntary redundancies. Okay, now our research partner in that part of the enterprise was the National Library of Australia. They have an oral history collection. It's been there for a number of decades now, interviewing anyone and everyone around the country. It might be a stockman, it might be a nurse, it might be Prime Minister, anyone. You know, it's a fantastic national resource that we have up there. And from their point of view, journalists are a group that they have not had too many of in their collection. And we as a research team could gain access to the journalists. So that was a useful partnership. So what we did was we chose about 60 of the many people who'd taken redundancy. You know, we wanted to make sure there were equal numbers of men and women. We wanted to make sure that there were people who'd worked in city media and country media and regional media, in print and radio and TV and online and, you know, over in the West here in Melbourne, which is where I am, up in Queensland and all around the country and so on. So sort of made sure we covered all of those bases to make it a truly representative project. And then we, over the past 5 years, we did these, what the library calls whole of life interviews, where, you know, you sit down and you literally you walk through the person's life and, you know, where were you born? Where did you grow up? How did you get into journalism? Why did you get into journalism? Who were your early mentors? What were some of the big stories you worked on? What were some of the difficulties that you encountered working as a journalist? What were some of the regrets that you might have had? And then all of that kind of life of a journalist, career of a journalist material, then we got to the point where, you know, we needed to cover off, well, okay, so you're going along in your career and then things happen to the media. You know, the internet arrives, it destroys the business model that had been in place for decades and decades, and the companies, the big media companies, were grappling with how to respond to that business model problem they had. And one of the ways they responded, not the only way, but one of the ways was to, you know, do a lot of voluntary redundancies, because, you know, it is still the case that the workforce makes up a major part of your overall costs. So that's what they did. We went through that particular process, as in the book, you know, where were you at that time? How did you greet that news? Were you told in a way that was kind of, you know, if you like, respectful and collegial, or were you kind of beaten over the head with it? And what was the experience like? Because some of these people many of them really were people who'd been in the industry for, you know, two or three or even four decades. And so, and they'd come into the industry at a time when, to be a journalist, you might not have become as wealthy as a doctor or as a lawyer or something, but you had a kind of a certain social cachet by dint of the fact that you worked either at a big city newspaper, or that you were in a country town and you had that local connection with your local community, or you were on the telly and you were a well-known face, and so on and so on. So you, for a lot of these people, their personal and professional identities were intertwined, and to leave that, even if it was voluntary, was hard, was a wrench. And so how did you experience that? What did you do next? You know, did you kind of just retire? Did you try and start up something? Did you go elsewhere in the media? What did you do and how did that go? So that's the sort of trajectory of the book. It starts with, where do journalists come from, I think is the title of the first chapter. And it ends up with where are we now? And in fact, it actually ends up with the riots on the Capitol in January 6th, because we were just particularly struck by that event, which is a remarkable historical event. And what did it say broadly about the world? You know, what did it say about the world that more people turned out in that election over in the United States than in any other? And if it alarmed some people that 74 million people voted for Donald Trump, you know, more than who had voted for him in the previous presidential election, about 81 million, I think, voted for Joe Biden. And we concluded that at least part of the reason for that huge outpouring of kind of, if you like, civic engagement over in the US was because of the role of the news media in telling people and informing them about what was going on in their country. Now Australia's not America, but, you know, it casts a large shadow, and a lot of the issues that are happening over there have also been happening in here, both politically and in our media system.
That's very interesting. The part of what you, in your answer then, you've spoken about people who have worked for long periods of time in the media and have taken voluntary redundancies, lost their jobs, some people, all sorts of things. And there's an essay, one of the earlier essays is by an academic professor now, Laurie Zion, who was a well-known journalist here in Australia.
Yes.
And that particular piece, I think it, to me at least, it was a really good introduction to the book, because it explained a few things I'd like you to comment on. First of all, there were some memories in the book about being at home and hearing, having radios on the background with news services on, and there were kids' TV shows that I remember watching it at school. We had to watch it every Tuesday or Wednesday morning behind the news, which was a sort of ABC television thing for kids, teaching them about the news. There's reference for newspapers calling it the Daily Miracle that it even gets produced.
Mm.
And then you have, I think the next chapter is about, or one of the later ones, is about the lost culture of the newsroom and how you get into a newsroom or into a newspaper and it has its own culture, good and bad. You talk about that there's sexism and there's all sorts of things happening, but there's also just hard work and people who are committed to things. Is that, was that transition from being brought up in a home where you heard news, you saw newspapers on tables, and then there was a culture you could then go into as a profession, has that been lost? How do children now grow up and transition into becoming journalists? How would that happen these days?
That is a really good question. And to be honest, I don't know the answer because, it's a long time since I've been a child. Also, it's a long time since my children have been children. And the people who we were speaking to were ranged in age from sort of about 40 to 65, so I guess one of the things you would be asking now, as in with young, you know, teenagers getting to that stage in their schooling where they're thinking about what they're going to do, would they be thinking about a career in journalism? And the evidence is that a lot of them still do. Equally, there are, you know, I mean, we have a course, for example, at Deakin where I am, in digital media, which it's all under the communications area, but it's digital media as distinct from journalism. And the enrolments in that are pretty strong because people have been different. I think one of the things that's captured their imagination now is the idea that, you know, with the mobile phone, you can create your own media. You know, that was not the case for all of those people who we interviewed in their childhoods. You know, this thing was on their table, you know, the newspaper, or this thing was on the television set in the corner of the lounge room. Now, the thing is the mobile phone, and you can, as we are doing right now, you can record interviews, you can go out and take pictures of newsworthy events, you can talk to people, you can immediately upload it and share it with anyone around the world. So I don't know. I'm not going to tell you I know because I don't know the answer to that, but I think it's a really good question, and I'm wondering what it is that will draw people into these sorts of roles, which in my view remain incredibly important. There's no doubt that they remain important. Are they as central as they were? I think not, but that doesn't mean they're still not important, and they're still not an awful lot of fun as well. You know, journalism I would always stress its importance, but it's a lot of fun going out and finding out what's going on and interviewing people and talking to them and, you know, going to all sorts of different places. I know we're all COVID constrained at the moment, so we can't do that, but so it's not just false nostalgia that I feel this. It is one of the things that is terrific about journalism, just going out and talking to people and finding out what's going on.
Yes. Yeah, I imagine it would be. Next chapter I wanted to ask your comment on is chapter 8. It's called Errors and Regrets, and you wrote that one.
Indeed, yep.
One of the things I took away from that chapter was an inbuilt fear in a journalist that when the story comes out, you do not want to see a mistake in it. It's almost like a keep you up at night sort of thing sometimes.
Mm.
The chapter Errors and Regrets warrant its own chapter rather than saying, okay, people make mistakes, but it seems to be a much bigger thing to journalists?
Yeah, that's true. Let me just quote the very beginning of it because it's not my line, it's somebody else's. But there's an adage that dates back to the 19th century that doctors bury their mistakes, lawyers hang theirs, but journalists print them on the front page of the newspaper or put them onto the evening bulletin. That's obviously a kind of a cynical line. It's a great line, but the thing about journalism in this context is that when you make an error, you make it in public. You might look stupid. Okay, that's one thing. That's not much fun to look stupid. But more to the point, or more weightily, you can be sued if you've got something significantly wrong and defame someone or, you know, sully their reputation. And that can cost your employer a lot of money. Or indeed, if you've made an error, like, for example, you've reported something once a person has been charged with a crime, and between that moment and the moment at which the matter is heard in court, the matter is sub judice, and you can't write anything or broadcast anything about that matter because it could prejudice the proceeding. So you're not allowed to do that. If you make that kind of mistake, as a young reporter did a few years ago here in Melbourne, you will not only get your bum kicked by the judge in the particular case, which the judge did very publicly, you'll get your bum kicked by your own news organisation. And, you know, for most people, if you make errors, you don't last long in the media. And I can imagine some people thinking that you know, almost guffawing at that idea because there are, you know, so many errors happen on a daily basis. And it appears often from the outside that journalists couldn't give a rat's if they made a mistake. But I know from being a journalist and I know from other journalists that it's seared into your soul that you must not make mistakes, and it hurts when you do. And so there's that. Those two reasons I've already mentioned to you. But the third one is that you are often writing about or broadcasting about events that are contested or, that carry a great deal of kind of weight for the people involved, whether it's a legal case or a a political matter, or indeed, you know, it might be to do with a sporting club or whatever. And so if you get something wrong in that context, it carries more weight than simply, you know, you forgot how many legs of a chair there were and you got that wrong. And you also get, you and your news organization get taken to task if you make an error. And so often, to give you a sharp example, let's say it's a piece of investigative journalism where you're not simply reporting, you know, today's unemployment figures, but you're reporting and asserting that someone has done something that's either corrupt or whatever. If you get one fact wrong in that, the whole thing can be unpicked like a bad piece of knitting, even though you might still have the heart of it right, but it's very easy for it to be picked off. And so journalists kind of develop this kind of rhinoceros-like hide to never admitting they make an error, even though they're in a business which, by its very nature, you know, it's fast, it's, you know, and it's contested, and you're almost always dealing with stuff you don't know a lot about. That is, that's the news. It's the new stuff. It's not the, let's go back and have a look at Charles I and what was said about him. It's new. So you are in a perilous environment, and the stakes are high, and so there are always going to be mistakes made, but it's hard to admit them for those kinds of reasons, because you're often in a kind of an arm wrestle with whoever it is that you're writing about or broadcasting about.
Yes. I've got two more questions about errors.
Sure.
First one is, my note here, I called it an institutional error, but that's probably not correct. It's almost like a cliche. So in Sydney, there's a notorious family, the OB family. They're in trouble for political sort of quasi-corruption, or real corruption, or all sorts of things. And it seems to me, if you're a journalist, you just have to mention that name and all the work is done. The character's built. It's mm-hmm. just the bad person. You don't actually have to do any. It's almost like you can't make an error. Everyone's just going to take that as true. I want to ask how that actually affects the quality of journalism. And secondly, how on earth would a journalist change that if they thought this is actually incorrect?
Yeah, okay. Good question. Okay, so taking the first one, we only have this view about Eddie Obeid as a result of a lot of investigative journalism, particularly by Kate McClymont at the Sydney Morning Herald, but also by dint of the investigative work that that ICAC, the Independent Commission Against Corruption, did on his various business affairs and land dealings and so on. So to me, that's on a pretty solid foundation. And if you just said Eddie Obeid is this or that, he would be the first one to sue you if it wasn't on that pretty solid foundation. But I think you're not kind of so much getting at that. Certain people get, if you like, there's a general taint over their reputation, and how easy or how difficult is it to unsmear that person once you've had that smear? And I think that is very difficult. You know, there's the famous line from Mark Twain about how the rumor is galloping halfway around the world while truth is still trying to put your shoes on in bed, you know. I do, and that kind of Mark Twain line from the 19th century has been, you know, again, turbocharged in the age of social media. I don't know how, what is curious to me as to how deeply held or not deeply held people's views are about, let's not use Eddie Obeid, but let's use person X, who's regarded as a, you know, some kind of shifty character. If someone actually met person X at a party or at a wherever, I suspect often they would give them a reasonable hearing. They'd sort of say, "Oh, aren't you person X, you know, that everybody says is this, that, and the other?" And if person X presented themselves and had a discussion with them, I don't know that, I guess I'm saying I don't know that those views are really deeply held. I think they're kind of, oh, I think so and so, oh, yeah, isn't he the person or isn't she the person who did this or that? And they're not deeply held. But probably easy for me to say in my circumstance. But what was the second thing you said? Because there was another point to your question.
Yeah, well, I guess it's I suppose another way of looking at it is, because you're right, OB may be he has investigative reporting behind it. But it's just almost a cliche. Someone can just become just the first in Sydney when the Delta variant came out, there was this story of some bloke who picked up someone at an airport and got off at a party. And
the limousine driver, yeah.
For a while, he was the guy we just all hated for a couple of weeks. Then there was the guy who apparently, punched a horse at a protest. He was the most hated man. He would have been hung up 100 years ago. But now it's just forgotten. It's almost like you just get this instant ability just to create this image of someone immediately. And I don't know if it would be very hard, it would seem to me, if you were the journalist working for the ABC or Channel 9 to actually portray that person in any other way.
Yeah.
You just almost couldn't do it.
Yeah. I think that's a fair point. And yet they're kind of, as you say, almost forgotten almost as quickly as they become a notorious figure. Like, I'll give you another example, and I'll be interested if you can remember this. One of these micro scandals. There was a chap whose name I won't mention, partly because I can't remember it, but I won't mention it anyway, who was alleged to have, he was filmed on his morning jog needing to stop and, you know, take a crap by the side of the road, you know, and he got known as the poo jogger, you know. And I don't know if you remember it, but it's exact. Well, that's kind of partly my point, but at the time, If you or I had been this person, we would have felt like the walls were falling on top of us, you know, because he was subjected to so many jokes and memes and kind of, tut-tutting and finger-pointing and all the rest of it. And yet, you know, if you bumped into him in the street now, A, you probably wouldn't recognize him, and B, you I don't know that you'd really – feel deeply about it. It would be more, you might feel a little bit of sympathy for him, I imagine, unless he happened to be on another jog and doing the same thing at the same time.
That's interesting. The next question, last question about errors and regrets.
Sure.
Do you think the role of a press conference, and you mentioned you do talk about press conference and public relations and things in this very chapter, is that a way of the subject of the news, the person, the politician, for example, trying to control the story? And does it become an easy way for news journalists who might be busy and there might be less of them now to actually get the story?
Press conferences or media conferences have been around for a long time, and they're a convenient way for a newsmaker, a politician, say, or someone else, a business leader, a trade union leader or whatever, to speak to the whole journalistic kind of community quickly and in one go rather than give 20 interviews. So that's why they were invented. And they're efficient as far as they go. There's certainly been some commentary about them in recent times because of the daily press conference that goes on, whether it's in New South Wales or in Victoria in particular. For overseas listeners, we've been having these because we've been locked down in the case of Victoria, in the south of Australia I think at the time we are speaking today, for longer than any other city in the world, and New South Wales and Sydney for less time. But politicians and chief medical officers use these as a way of talking to the broad community and via the journalists. What a lot of people who watch these press conferences every day are noticing, which they normally would never, they'd never watch a press conference. They would just get the kind of highlights on the evening news or in the paper the next day, is that they're noticing how repetitive they are, how much they think the journalists are kind of mugging for the cameras and so on. It's a bit, I'd put it down to a little bit like that that kind of line from Otto Bismarck that, you know, laws are like sausages. You know, you don't really want to see them being made. And you don't really want to see journalism being made in this context. It's pretty unedifying a lot of the time. So no, they're not new. They've been around for a while. We just are noticing them more at the moment because of COVID-19, I think.
Okay. Chapters 9 and 10, I have a question about them. They seem to work together. They deal with chapter 9 is Meryn Sherwood and yourself wrote that one. And chapter 10 is a biotossin called Brad Buller.
Yes.
They deal with the traumatic aspects of being a journalist, knocking on the door, was it called knocking on grass or something? Yes. Some sort of line they have, and then work-life imbalance.
Yeah.
And what these said, and I'd like your comment on this, is that when you are a journalist, it's almost vocational. It's just like it just seems to be your life if you're a news journalist. It's all consuming, all controlling, and you've just got to become desensitized and just suck it up and just roll with it and meet deadlines. And I imagine some go to war zones to get families and things. What's the character of a journalist you have to be like to deal with all that?
Yeah, okay. Well, to deal with all of that, particularly some of those sharper things that you're talking about, you need a fair amount of resilience. And some people, you know, clearly some people are more resilient than others. And so what tends to happen is that the sort of person who's dead keen to be in a war zone and covering a war ends up being the sort of person who actually gets chosen. And if that's not really your forte or what you think you could do, you tend to end up in another part of the news organization doing other work. So there's a kind of element of natural self-selection that goes on. That said, there is also, and this has been a subject of a couple of court cases here in Victoria in recent years, where journalists and photographers have sued their news organizations on the grounds that they argued they were negligent for not taking proper care of them and so them suffering occupational post-traumatic stress disorder. Okay. One case was unsuccessful. The second case was successful, and the news organization needed to pay quite a lot of money in damages to that particular journalist. So the stakes are high. And so I'd say a couple of things about that. The first is that it's entirely possible that anyone and everyone in a newsroom will cover difficult events, whether it's a car collision, whether it's needing to ring someone who's lost a loved one in a car collision or something of that kind, or a bushfire. I'll give you one example where a reporter at The Age, which is the last newspaper I worked at, this is during the time of the Black Saturday bushfires here in Victoria, which were the worst bushfires in terms of loss of life in Victoria in its history. All of the regular reporters go out and we're covering all sorts of parts of those series of fires. And after a few days, you kind of rotate them out and bring in more people. One of the people who was sent out early on was a journalist whose normal round, if you like, was covering the arts. They were an arts, and they'd been an arts reporter for the best part of a decade, covering the opera and new films and new this and new that. Very good journalist. This is Gabriella Koslovich. Very good journalist. But big story like that happens, it's all hands to the pump. So you out you go. And so that's the first thing, that it's quite common, whether on a city news organization and particularly out in the bush, where you kind of have to cover anything and everything, that you will cover difficult traumatic events, because whatever else is happening in the world, sadly, fires, floods, death, sexual assault, et cetera, these things just keep happening and they need to be reported. So what the court cases that have been going on have been about is to, in a way, to highlight the fact that media organisations have been poor at providing proper support before, during, and after these kind of events happen. So preparing journalists who need to cover events, supporting them while they're out there, and then checking in with them afterwards to see if, you know, if they're coping, whether they need a couple of days off before they come back, whether they need to debrief with someone, whatever. It is true, and it is an area that I've actually done some academic work on, that news organisations, not simply the one that was sued, which was in fact the Age newspaper, but others, have not done this particularly well. There is an awareness of the need to do it, and that's been kind of crystallised by that judgment in that court case. But at the same time, the media is not earning as much money as it used to in terms of profits, and so it's leaner, and so there is a problem. There is a real problem there, and there are fewer older journalists around who tended to be the ones who would often provide that kind of, you know, informal mentoring in a newsroom. Just, you know, help someone, take them aside and say, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? Do you want to have a chat about that story you just covered, which, you know, was particularly difficult or whatever? There's less of that. That is a genuine problem. And the other chapter that you mentioned, written by Brad Buller, and Brad Buller, I should say, was one of the people who worked on the project. He did a lot of work, particularly on this book, but he also did some work on the overall New Beats project, but played quite a significant role in pulling together the book and some of the material you mentioned a bit earlier. Like there's a chronology of all of the different kind of job losses at the back. You know, Brad did a lot of work on that and so on. So what he wanted to do also was to write one of the chapters, which he did, which is this notion that you were referring to earlier, that, you know, you're never quite off duty as a journalist. And so if something happens, then bang, you have to go and start covering it. We know you don't have to, but most journalists will choose to go out and start covering it. And there's few journalists that I know who haven't either had a summer holiday interrupted by needing to cover a bushfire or whatever it might be, or something that's happened in their local area, and they start doing their reporting, etc. It's just it's kind of in the culture of news. It's what's expected of you to do.
Interesting.
Yeah, but the other part of it is the effect it has on family life, which is what you were kind of, I think, alluding to. And it is significant. Like there's historically lots of, you know, broken marriages, lots of alcoholism in the industry. Less of that these days, as in less alcoholism, but still pretty heavy toll. I don't imagine it's much different to sort of, I don't know, some big city law firms, which seem to be pretty brutal places to work as well.
Yeah, no, that's, not alone there in that field, but yeah, no.
Or indeed a medicine. Imagine if you were working in a hospital system at the moment, yeah.
Really terrible, yeah. You have to finish up pretty soon as well.
Sure.
Min's going to miss out a few questions, but that's all right. I'll go to the one I wanted to ask about next. It was the chapter called Chasing Clicks, chapter 11. I think that was by Maren Sherwood and Andrew Dodd. What I want to ask you goes back to what we were talking about earlier, is in Sydney, if I'm in Sydney, you're in Melbourne, there's The Age, the Fairfax Press, and there's the Sydney Morning Herald, or now it's Channel 9, I think, owns it.
Mm.
And when I was a kid, the Sydney Morning Herald was something that came, you could tear it up, you could grab chips in it. Nowadays, I don't think that a child would think that there is such a thing as a piece of paper called the Sydney Morning Herald. It's just something you find through Google.
Mm.
That's one, obviously, big change. But the second thing is about the new media formats, is when you go to those news websites now, the written word is only, I imagine, just such a small portion of the presentation that's given to the viewer. There's video, there's audio, there's all sorts of things. To me, that's good and bad. One is bad, maybe, because you don't have the actual, I don't know how much the art of being a writer is, and it necessarily is if that's the main feature anymore of a newspaper. But secondly, the good thing is it seems to be open to younger people because it speaks their language. It's the sort of, they could probably start really contributing to that format in ways people might not be as brought up in. What are your thoughts on the way in which the positives and
negatives are? Oh, look, I'd agree with you about there being good and bad. The good side is that you used to have to go to different media forms to get either the audio or the video as well as the text, and now you can get all of it from not only from the Sydney Morning Herald but from the ABC, which historically produced radio and television, now produces a lot of stuff online and produces you know, often quite long articles about various topics, you know, which they never used to do. So what the bad side of it potentially is that, as you're alluding to, the, if you like, the writing, how much attention is paid to the writing, it's, I think the speed and the smaller or lower numbers of staff have had an impact there, as in that one of the vital layers in the cake has been, if not removed, then certainly much diminished, and that is what are called sub-editors who are between you as the writer or the writing journalist and the production of the newspaper or of the radio broadcast or whatever and the public. And they would do everything from fix your spelling to if indeed you did misspell something, to ask you questions about whether you defamed someone, to providing some context that you might have missed, to just clarifying something or helping ask questions to clarify something that you in the rush had only partly digested. And a good sub-editor, and any honest journalist will tell you this, as any honest reporter will tell you this, because journalists are sub-editors as well, that good sub-editors are really important. And that is one of the losses, to the point which some news organisations have realised that, and they're starting to rehire some sub-editors, because they are important. And I mean, the writing, I agree, is really important. That the actual the experience of reading something that is well written, you know, and we've got some excellent journalists in this country who write extremely well. I just read something this morning from Malcolm Knox, who's a Sydney person who wrote about the state of Australian cricket, what's going on there. I imagine that was in the Sydney Morning Herald as well as in The Age this morning when I read it. You know, he's not only a good thinker, but he's a good writer. And so you'll read what he has to write, read what he has written because of that. And there are other places where that the writing is prized, like in the Quarterly Essay or the, you know, those sorts of publications. But I certainly out at the uni where I'm at, we aim to teach that so that people's writing is clear and succinct and accurate, obviously, but also that does develop a bit of a rhetorical style so that it will carry readers along.
Yes, okay. Second last question. You are a professor in communications at Deakin University. Why should someone come along to study communications in this day and age?
Okay. Communications broadly, I need to make that argument. I mean, if in the sense that if there's one thing about the global pandemic that we've seen is that the ability to communicate clearly and succinctly and to cut through noise is really prized. And conversely, the ability to obfuscate or avoid questions or whatever drives people up the wall. So I don't think I need to make an argument about the teaching people how to communicate well is really important. But I suspect partly your question is about why study journalism today as distinct from, public relations or something like that. And my argument would be the same as it's been for many years, which is that I think journalism plays a vital role in a democracy and we need more of it, not less of it, and particularly when there is a lot of spin and public relations, which I'm not saying there's no place for public relations, but it is a kind of a profession that does get used in some pretty rough and willing ways and in ways that are counter to the good running of a democracy and the part of the problem is that there are more public relations practitioners than journalists now in the country.
Is that right?
Yep. Yep.
So the
but see that. So, sorry, what were you?
Nothing. So this is the fourth state notion is that where you're talking of journalism being a bastion of democracy.
Yes, I am, and you know, it's by no means a perfect bastion. There's, you know, we could spend another hour talking about its imperfections, but it remains important, and the public relations as an industry, which includes a lot more than simply engaging with the media and trying to either spin them one way or spin them the other way. But there are, I'll give you an example in the, I think in the, under the Andrews government in Victoria, which is the state government here in Victoria, the number of people who provide communications advice and expertise, I think has doubled in the last 4 or 5 years. There's a lot of them, and I think more than just about any other state. And the same applies actually to the Prime Minister's Office, the Federal Prime Minister of Australia, and the number of communications people working in the Prime Minister's Department.
Gosh, that's a bit of a worry. Okay, well, thank you. Just before we go, but thank you very much for your time.
Sure.
What are you working on next or now?
I'm glad you asked that, actually, because this has been I very much enjoyed the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners. But I'm working right now with a colleague, Patrick Mullins, on a book about the ABC, which is the title is "Who Needs the ABC?" And I'm happy to tell you that our answer is we all need the ABC, and if you like, the book is was prompted by the idea that the under the current government in particular, they have moved a motion at their own party conference a couple of years ago to abolish, or if not abolish, then privatise the ABC, and so the ABC, you know, which is nearly 90 years old as an institution, may not reach its centenary if the current government actually has its way. And so I think we need to start a debate and a discussion about what the value of the ABC is to the broader community.
Yeah, you start seeing those bumper stickers again. I listen to the ABC and I vote.
Yeah.
Wow.
Exactly. That's what's it's in the works at the moment. It should be coming out early next year through Scribe Publications.
Great. Okay, Matthew. Well, thank you very much for your time today. That was Matthew Ricketson, who has a book published by UNSW Press called Upheaval, Disrupted Lives in Journalism, with a pretty good cover, actually, a typewriter and a laptop sort of merging one into the other. You'll see it in bookstores. Grab a copy. Thank you very much, Matthew, for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for your time as well, Bede.
No worries. Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for listening to the New Books Network.